So as an educator, you know that every student, every person learns differently. Maybe they have different learning styles. Maybe they have different interests that can attract them to the information that you're trying to get into their heads, the content you're trying to deliver. And as an educator, you're always working to make those connections, to better understand how your students learn and how you can meet them with that content. And one of the perpetual challenges in education is giving the right kind of support and enough support for students with learning disabilities. Studies show that 1 in 5 students has a learning disability like dyslexia. That means that if you're a classroom teacher, you're going to encounter these students. And there are going to be special procedures. There are even laws like IDEA, which deals with learning disabilities in special education from a legal, federal standpoint, as well as that law's 504 provisions about students that don't meet the normal requirements for special education. And that's all in addition to the kinds of things you normally do, working with parents, students, and administrators to meet all of your learning goals. Now, October is Learning Disabilities Awareness Month, so we're going to spread a little awareness in this week's meeting of the EdTech Club. Our guest speaker comes from the National Center for Learning Disabilities. Her name is Megan Whitaker, and you may remember her from an earlier episode. This time, she's returning to the club to talk about racial disparities when it comes to learning disabilities and new data about those disparities, specifically what they call a disproportionality between racial groups. She's going to help us dive into this data and tell us a little bit about what it means and what you as an educator can do to be aware of and reactive to learning disabilities in your classroom. So it's an incredibly relevant discussion, and it's driven by some very interesting findings. So that's what we're talking about in this meeting of the EdTech Club, and it all starts right now. Hey everybody, I'm Andrew Rausch, and welcome back to another meeting of the EdTech Club, the podcast from TCEA all about technology, education, and how those two things come together to inspire learning. This week's learning topic for our club members is learning disabilities and what we're learning about the difference between different groups across racial disparities and income disparities and what that new data is telling us about understanding and assisting students with learning disabilities. But I'm not the expert, Megan Whitaker is. And to prove she is, I'll let her introduce herself.
So my name is Megan Whitaker. I am the Director of Policy and Advocacy at the National Center for Learning Disabilities. And NCLD is a nonprofit advocacy organization that works to improve the lives of the 1 in 5 who have learning and attention issues nationwide. And we do that by empowering parents and young adults, transforming schools, and advocating for equal rights and opportunities for students.
In practice, what does that mean in terms of National Council for Learning Disabilities? What is your mission and how do y'all go after that goal?
Yeah, so our mission is to really remove barriers to success for young people with learning and attention issues and to increase opportunities. And when we talk about learning and attention issues, we're talking about disabilities that impact reading, writing, math, attention, processing, and executive functioning skills. So it's the largest category of disability recognized under federal law. And we advocate not only for students who have diagnosed disorders or disabilities under IDEA or 504, but we also advocate for students who may not be receiving services or have any formal diagnosis. And we work on behalf of all of those students at a federal level, working with Congress and with the Department of Education to really push for policy change that will make an impact and get best practices and information and resources out to school districts to help improve what's happening in schools as well.
And just to give us some context on where education is in terms of understanding learning disabilities, what is the awareness of learning disabilities now, and how has that changed over the past few years?
Well, I think the general public, a lot of people say the term learning disabilities and kind of use it as an all-encompassing term to recognize any kind of disability that might impact learning. But learning disabilities are actually a specific diagnosis or category under federal law. And I don't know how familiar people are generally with
the
learning
National
disabilities.
Center
I think
for
many
learning
educators have a good understanding that we're really talking about dyslexia, which is a reading disability, dyscalculia, which is a math disability.
The National Center for Learning Disabilities.
And we're talking about, you know, challenges specifically with reading, writing, processing,
the National
things
Center for
like
Learning
that.
Disabilities.
And IDEA as a federal special education
the
law
National
is really
Center
specific when
it
comes to the processes that should be followed by schools when evaluating students with learning disabilities, though there are standards for how to identify any disability, but learning disabilities tend to be one of the lengthier or more prescribed evaluation processes under federal education law.
And October is Learning Disabilities Awareness Month. One of the things that your group is doing this month, and one of the things that are involved in spreading awareness, is around racial educational disparity. So we understand that perhaps a learning disability could affect anyone. It wouldn't matter your social, cultural, religious, et cetera, background. However, you're releasing some data, some trends that you're seeing that are showing disproportionality, as you call it, between racial groups.
Yes. And I want to make sure people know this is not a new trend. The term significant disproportionality has been around a while. And not too many years ago, there were efforts by the Department of Education to try to address this at a federal level. We are releasing these materials specifically because this is a term many people probably aren't familiar with. And we want to make sure that there's a clear picture of the data, of the trends that we're seeing, and that people have easy access to understanding how this issue impacts individuals, whether they are low-income students, whether they're African-American or Black students, whether they are Latinx or English learners. And so disproportionality affects different populations in different ways, and NCLD really wanted to get this information out there to make sure that people become more familiar with disproportionality, and we have more of an awareness of why it matters and why we should really begin addressing this now as a society.
And so how would you define for the layman this term of disproportionality? I mean, I think it's kind of clear from the word itself, but can you give us a specific way that you're thinking about it?
Yes. So that term, significant disproportionality, is really a term of art that refers to three different kinds of aspects of the educational experience of students. The first is identification for special education. Is this student eligible for services under IDEA? The second is educational placement. Once a student's identified as eligible for special education, in what kind of setting is he then taught? And the third is discipline. So what is the experience that this student has when it comes to school discipline after being labeled a student with a disability? So disproportionality refers to all three of those areas, and we see alarming trends across all three of those.
Mm-hmm. And so take us into some of these trends, some of the data that you're sharing.
Sure. So first, you know, students of color are disproportionately enrolled in special education as compared to their enrollment in the general school population. So in other words, schools are identifying higher rates of disability within certain groups of students. If a certain group of students is, you know, 20% of the school population, you might expect them to be 20% of students with disabilities. But in fact, we're seeing higher rates of disability. And I can go into specific data points on identification. So for example, students of color, with the exception of Asian American students, are identified for special ed at higher rates than white peers. Black students are 40% more likely to be identified with a disability versus other students. And American Indian and Alaska Native children receive special ed at twice the rate of the general student population. So those are two of the, I think, most alarming data points on identification. When it comes to after you are enrolled in special education, students of color tend to be placed in more segregated settings. So they you know, typically we would want most students to be educated in general education along with peers who don't have disabilities, because research has shown that that is a best practice. There is benefit to having students with disabilities in the general education classroom. But unfortunately, students of color spend less time in general education and more time separated from their peers. So as a data point, you know, an example there, more than half of white students with disabilities, about 55% of them, spend more than 80% of their day in general ed classrooms, but only a third of Black students spend that much time in general education classrooms. And Latinx and American Indian students with disabilities are also more likely to be taught in those separate classrooms compared to white students. And then the third area is discipline. So students with disabilities who are also students of color have higher rates of discipline and harsher discipline for the same types of behavior that you would see from white students with disabilities. And an example there is that Black students are 3 times more likely than white students to be suspended or expelled, just generally as a demographic. And then that data is even worse for students with disabilities who are students of color. They have much higher punishment rate. And Black males from low-income background will receive who receive special education are suspended at the highest of any other subgroup of students. So we really are concerned about these trends, and there's a lot to unpack when it comes to this data, but the trends in and of themselves are alarming and worth digging into and really unpacking more.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a clear red flag when you can see that disproportionality in the numbers. There's a number, as you say, of follow-up questions, things to unpack. I guess the first question is, how do you begin to explain this disproportionality?
Yeah.
Where is that, you know, have you begun to identify the causes of that?
Yeah, and a lot of research has been done. And I would say that there's differing schools of thought on the rationale behind this or what might be contributing to it. There's a lot of complexity here, right? There's no clear answer, but I want to share with you kind of 2 areas that have been explored. The first is really thinking about race and income together. We know that race and income are highly correlated in our country. So you might think that if students of color are also low income students, we might expect them to have higher rates of disability. The thinking being students who experience poverty would likely be exposed to things that might increase their chance of having a disability or developing a disability. And we do know that there is some connection between adverse childhood experiences and disability. And when I say adverse childhood experience, that's another term people call, you know, talk about ACE scores. So things like economic hardship or poverty, the death of a parent, witnessing violence, those kinds of things can certainly impact the development of a child. And we need to consider how those might impact learning. And that could, of course, be part of what's going on, is that there may be higher rates of disability for certain groups of students. But we know that disability is not driven by race. And so our goal is to really get the right kinds of supports to students. And if we see that there are higher rates of disability or need, we really need to dig into what is that need. Is it that this child grew up in poverty and they have experienced housing and food insecurity or emotional difficulties due to witnessing violence? Because the solution for those students wouldn't then be special education necessarily. We need to get them the right resources. So we want to be careful that special education isn't the fix if we're trying to really address what is the result of poverty or some other challenge that child or their family is facing. But the second, I think, the biggest concern for me is that we can't ignore bias and racism. And we really need to understand how that might be playing a factor in the trends that we're seeing here. And the latest research that I can point to that really gets at this is research out of Harvard. Todd Grindle and Laura Shifter are 2 researchers who really looked at students within the same income bracket. So they really tried to control for income and figure out, is income driving this or is race driving these trends that we're seeing? And what they found was that when you're looking at students within the same income bracket, so you're either only comparing low-income background students or students from non-low-income backgrounds, Black and Hispanic students were still more likely to be identified for special education compared to white peers. So income alone could not explain away the difference in identification rates for students with disabilities of various racial or ethnic backgrounds. So that is something really important to drive change in our schools, that, you know, race seems to be a bigger factor here than income. So even if we believe that student experiences, poverty, exposure to violence might be influencing their development and their learning, it alone doesn't explain away all of the difference, and that race and potentially bias in our school system really plays a big role here.
Mm. And you could see very easily how that can become maybe not causal, but cyclical in its own way, of a lower income student being assumed to have these kinds of needs, or being assumed to be put in this kind of class, affecting their outcomes, affecting their income as they grow older, and affecting a new generation as we keep going.
Absolutely. And I just also want to say that it's important to be clear here. IDEA is an incredibly beneficial law, and it offers a lot of protections, services to students and their families. And those are essential. So in no way is this meant to criticize IDEA, but we also need to recognize the flip side of this, that inappropriately placing children into special education could cause short or long-term harm to those students, particularly if they are students from low-income backgrounds, students of color, who are facing a lot of stigma and have received labels that affect their outcome and their trajectory in life. So, we don't want to misidentify students, because we know that, you know, when you enter special education, there is a tendency or there is a risk that students will be exposed to less rigorous curriculum. They might have, be held to lower expectations, and they might receive fewer opportunities to succeed or, you know, transition to college and the workforce. So that is what we're trying to guard against. It's not that we want to keep students out of special education if it is needed. We really need to have the whole picture in mind when we're making these decisions, because it does affect the trajectory of students, particularly if they are not students who would benefit from special education.
Yeah. And so as you lay out, we know that it's not a causal relationship between race or ethnic group and academic success. We know that it's not completely a class or income-based causality, because we know that when we compare across ethnic and racial groups within a certain income level, it's still disproportionate for those ethnic minority groups, meaning there is some kind of other aspect, a social aspect, a aspect of bias involved.
Yes, and there's one other layer to that research that I mentioned out of Harvard that I think, you know, explains some of that. So they found that the magnitude of disparity in identification was greatest for disabilities that we consider to be subjective disability, you know, diagnoses or labels. So if you think, for example, of vision or hearing, right? There is a clear root cause as to why a child cannot hear or cannot see, and they are diagnosed with that particular type of disability. It is a pretty clear-cut analysis that you do to determine whether that child has vision or has hearing. But there are other disabilities that we consider to be more subjective in terms of how we identify those students. This is not to say that the evaluation process is that clear-cut, but for example, for students who have learning disabilities or emotional disturbance, a lot of what goes into that evaluation really is the professional judgment that's being used by people involved in the evaluation. They're looking at observations, they're interpreting student behavior, they're interpreting how a student is engaging in their learning and making decisions about, is what we're seeing laziness, is what we're seeing inability to control emotions, or is it that this child is really struggling to the level that rises to disability? And so the more subjective those analyses are, or the more opportunity there is for observations and personal beliefs and perceptions to be part of that process, the more at risk that process is to be subjective or to be affected by somebody's own bias. And so that's the really interesting finding here, is that we know that students of color are going to experience higher rates of identification and then be on this trajectory And it is more apparent for those subjective categories of disability than it is for the less subjective ones.
It almost sounds to me related to sort of the discussion around bias in testing and assessments and even cultural bias in those kinds of assessments. You know, if a teacher speaks almost exclusively in metaphor and a student comes from a house where that kind of language just isn't used, it may be really hard for them to catch up and realize what the educator's saying, for example.
Absolutely. And a big part of our evaluation process is assessment and observation. And so if that's if we are not taking a close look at how human beliefs, biases, and perceptions are part of that process, we won't have an objective and very sensitive or accurate evaluation process. And so one of the things that we're recommending in the resources we're putting out and that we're really calling for in terms of policy and practice change is an audit of existing policies. The districts who are leading the way in addressing these disparities are those who are bringing in outside experts to do an audit of evaluation processes, of discipline policies, of all of the things that we put on paper and we think are going to be applied equally, but then in practice, you know, are subject to the humans who implement them. And so we really need to examine the beliefs of educators and administrators who are leading our schools and examine how they interact with those policies that have been put in place so that we can make changes that will push us in the right direction to reducing these disparities.
And I guess one kind of final thought, I mean, obviously there's things leaders and administrators can do. If I'm an individual educator or classroom teacher, I'm trying to keep aware of these kinds of disproportionalities that you're sharing. I also can just maybe see in my classroom the disparities across income levels or across racial and ethnic groups or any other, you know, minority-majority kind of relationship especially. What can I be doing on a day-to-day basis to sort of counter those disproportionalities?
I think a good first step for any individual within the education system would be to really directly examine and address your own bias. If you haven't begun to really grapple with that, that is the first place to start. To really get a sense of your own beliefs, your own biases, to see how those might be playing out in your classroom or your school, depending on your role, and encouraging others within your school to do the same so that it can be a school-wide effort to really address these kinds of policies. But I also think another practical thing that educators can do is to better involve families in this process. I think depending on you know, a family's cultural background, their language proficiency, factors like that are going to affect how they engage with the school. And families have to be an essential part of the evaluation process. If we want to get a full picture and understanding of a child, their socio-cultural economic background, we also have to understand and engage with their family. So even as an educator or a single individual in this process, you know, meaningfully bringing in parents and families into this process can go a long way to informing the evaluation process and making sure that it is considering all of the relevant contextual factors that are going to influence that child's learning. And then I would say the third thing is push your district for to get you more training, more professional development on evidence-based practices. It is not enough to just respond to these disparities if we're not also bringing in the good practices, the evidence-based instruction. We need to be supporting all students earlier. If in fact we know that students from low-income families and communities are struggling with certain things, we need to bring in high-quality evidence-based instruction in literacy and math. We've got to be bringing in whole child approaches like social emotional learning. We've got to bring in MTSS and positive behavior supports to really help the whole child and provide interventions before we resort to a special education evaluation. That's just good practice. And so having educators who push for that kind of professional development and encourage those practices in schools will help us get there more quickly, because early intervention and high quality instruction is a great place to start to prevent, you know, misidentification of students when they've gotten to the point of getting an evaluation and being on the path to special education.
Absolutely. Well, dang, Megan, you make an interviewer's job easy. let's see. Is there anything I haven't asked you or you want to make sure you include, calls to action, that sort of stuff?
So I want to mention that NCLD just launched a new online tool, which really gets to this idea of identification of issues early and early intervention. And this tool is called the LD Checklist. And this checklist has been around for many years, and we recently revamped it with the help of some experts and made it an interactive online tool that educators, pediatricians, and parents can use to detect the potential signs of LD and understand, you know, what's going on with their child. So for each issue area, you can select, you know, your grade level and the specific issues you might be observing in a child, and then determine whether further screening or evaluation might be helpful. So for any educators looking to help parents understand what they're seeing, or to really try to target issues before they rise to the level of needing an evaluation, that tool will be a great place to start. And it's the LD Checklist, available at ncld.org/LD Checklist.
Okay, friends, we only have so much time for these meetings, I understand, but some housekeeping notes here at the end. First, your homework is to check out the show notes. We've got links about IDEA, about Section 504, and about the new data that Megan shared with us. That's all in the description for this episode, the show notes. Don't forget to like, subscribe, share the show, tell your friends, and keep in touch with us. You can hit us up at podcast@tcea.org with your thoughts and ideas. You know to keep up with the very latest from TCEA by following us on social media. We've got a big group of educators out there on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter. Make sure you're following to keep up with the latest. And take a spin over to tcea.org/events. We've got a lot coming up, many of them virtual to meet your needs, in addition to a number of new courses and certifications that are going to help you get a leg up on your teaching no matter what comes in the future. That's tcea.org/events. And don't forget about our biggest EdTech event of the year coming up in February 2021, the TCEA Convention and Exposition. This is going to be a big, exciting event with a lot of new ways to interact. But I won't spill all the beans now. You can go check that out at convention.tcea.org. And that's it. We've got a lot to think about this week and a lot to think about going into next week, when we will meet again for another conclave of this techie crew, the EdTech Club. And I hope you'll be there with us. But until then, I'm Andrew Rausch. Thanks for being part of the club. EdTech Club is a production of TCEA. To learn more and to join, go to tcea.org.